Hey guys, I'm Valerie.
And I'm Jasmine, and this is Crafts, Drafts, and Crime.
Today, I am bringing you a story that a lot of you might be familiar with. Now, I was somewhat familiar with this case, but I didn't know all the nitty-gritty details, and honestly, they're terrible. So, I have lots of triggers for this episode, and we are going to be talking about James Bulger. Are you familiar with him?
The name does not sound familiar to me.
Okay. We will see. If at any point in time you do realize that you do know this, let me know. I know a lot of people are going to be like, oh shit, when they click the episode. So sources for today are Northwest Evening Mail, the Sunday Times Magazine, True TV's Death of James Bulger by Shirley Lynn Scott, The Guardian, UK Essays, The Independent, ChildhoodTraumaRecovery.com, TheSun.co.uk, BBC, the Parliament.UK's House of Lords website, Liverpool Echo, Oxford Dictionary, the Daily Telegraph, Blackpool Gazette, the Yorkshire Post, and ABC. Triggers for this episode include child abuse, child sexual abuse, bullying, discussion of suicide, domestic violence, and drug and alcohol use. Lots of heavy hitters. I will give you one major trigger warning throughout, like during the episode, but just be cautioned that there's a lot of terrible shit going to happen here. Are you ready?
I am ready to be destroyed.
On February 12th, 1993, two 10-year-old boys, Robert Thompson and John Venables, were playing hooky. It's something they did frequently. John even had a spot where he would ditch his backpack to retrieve it later. I want to tell you first a little bit about their childhoods. So, John Venables, I'm going to start with him. His parents, Susan and Neil, married in 1975 when Susan was 18 and Neil was 22. After 4 years of marriage, they went on to have three kids. Paul in 1979, Jonathan in 1982, and Sandra in 1983. Paul was born with a cleft lip and he had surgery as a baby. He couldn't speak or express himself when he was a child, so until he was about 4 years old, he was always upset and crying. As he got older, he was put in special education classes. When John came along, he was the perfect baby in the Venables' eyes. He wasn't fussy. He learned to walk very quickly at 11 months. Is that actually quick? I have no idea.
I think that might be a little quick, yeah.
Okay. And he learned to talk that they said was quickly at 15 months.
Yeah, that's pretty quick.
Okay. And he was fully potty trained by age 2.
That's pretty quick.
Okay. So they said in all accounts that he was pretty intelligent and very quick. So when Sandra was born, John was always wanting to be around her. He used to always say, baby, and the two would look at each other, just like constantly. The Venables said it was adorable. When Sandra was 2, the Venables realized that she had a couple of issues also. She wasn't an unhappy baby like Paul, but she also wasn't quick and super intelligent like John. They figured that she was honestly probably just a little bit lazy. Sandra ended up being a little bit slower in her learning ability, so after a few years in ordinary classes, she was put into special education classes. But before they were school-aged, Susan recalls feeling trapped with the kids in the house all the time because she was a stay-at-home mom, and Neil worked odd jobs. He hadn't had a steady job since 1983, when he was 30 years old. So Susan needed to get out a lot more. Being a stay-at-home mom just made her feel kind of trapped sometimes. But Neil grew up with his mother being a stay-at-home mom who did everything around the house and was always there. So that's the kind of life that he wanted for himself and for Susan. So he wasn't any help when she needed a break or when she needed some encouragement or some help.
I feel like a lot of times people don't think that, like, back in the day, like, maybe they didn't, like, your moms didn't really have a choice but to stay home with the kids. But, like, the way that she's feeling right now, it was probably postpartum, to be honest. Because I know with me, after I had Ollie, I went through a really bad, like, postpartum ordeal with her, just because I was trying to pump and I was trying to breastfeed and she wasn't latching, and it was a whole thing. And so when I was pumping, you're supposed to pump like every 2 hours. So you pump for 30 minutes at a time. And then that's 30 minutes into the 2 hours that you're supposed to wait between pumps. And then you're spending that time, like, trying to feed the baby, or the baby's sleeping, so you're trying to do something else. And then you basically only have, like, an hour and a half to an hour to do whatever you need to do. And then you're hooked right back onto that pump, or right back onto the baby. So it, like, feels like you're just in this spiral that's never ending. Like a merry-go-round, and you're just going and going and going, and it's never ending. And it's depressing after a while.
I can definitely see that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's common, like, men don't understand that. And, you know, that's because nobody ever talks to men about, like, how that feels. Or sometimes you get men that don't give a shit, and then they're just like, whatever, you're the woman, you're the mother, you need to get over it and deal with it. So right. I totally feel where she's coming from.
I completely understand how she could feel trapped too. And I know I've had friends who are stay-at-home parents, and very much the argument has always been between them and their spouse that, okay, well, I need to get out. Like, I can't just be mom 24/7, 365. Like, I need to be able to get out and do things too and have a separate life. Like, you could have a separate life. And the man's argument is always, well, I go to work. And they're like, yeah, but you go to work and then you get to come home. And
right,
you don't have to be a parent even all night when you're here. Like, you can come home, and I have done this and this and this, which, you know, there, you know, a lot of women think is reasonable because they're the ones who are home all day. So why should he have to go to work and then come home and cook? But, you know, for them, they don't get that break then either, because no matter which scenario you're in, nobody's getting a break. She's constantly, or he's coming home from work, and then he's constantly with them. There's no happy medium. So my solution to that is don't have children.
Hey, and that's a perfectly healthy solution. I am down with you with that. I support you with that for sure. It's either you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't when it comes to being a parent. Because, like, you're damned if you stay at home, you raise your kids, you know, one person goes to work. Like you said, the whole example that you just said is perfect. Like, it makes sense. And then imagine if you both work, and then it's like, well, who's going to call out when the kid is sick? Who's going to have to take your kid? Who's going to have to miss time from work? Who's going to have to do all this other stuff whenever they come home for work? And then it just, it's this whole thing. Like, for some reason, society has us thinking one way, and then, like, everything is set up to make you fail in a way, which is why I feel like a lot of people, like, end up getting a divorce, because there's always one parent who feels like they're doing more than the other.
And it's usually true.
That's my tangent. And now I'm over. I'm done with it. I'm sorry to bring it here. But yeah, either way.
So in conclusion, it makes perfect sense that Susan can feel this way. And so when her dad died in 1983, she moved in with her mom and she took the kids with her. And Neil moved out, and they sold their house. Neil came around on the weekends. It was actively a part of the kids' lives. They ended up getting a divorce, but they actually remained very close. They still referred to each other as their best friend. And after a while, they began having a sexual relationship again, and they even went on family vacations together. So, though that doesn't sound like a bad thing to do, and probably, you know, kids who had their parents divorced and they're young, it's probably a dream come true for some of them, for their parents to get back together. But this also could have been incredibly confusing, and it's not clear how this affected their three kids and what they thought was normal. So that was the situation with his parents. When John was 7, the family moved, and some of the kids on the block called Paul names, which made John incredibly upset. He was struggling at the new school, and he became more and more unhappy. The more unhappy he was, the more trouble he wanted to cause. It was also around this time that Susan had two traumatic medical issues. So John began getting teased at school, which led to him being even more disruptive in class. He was considered by his teachers to be a low achiever, even though they knew that he was incredibly intelligent. Then there was an incident in which John held a ruler to a kid's throat, which resulted in him being suspended for 2 days. Susan decided that she would teach him from home for 10 weeks, and the school never contacted them to check up on them. Eventually, this led to him being held back a year. I know on the surface, this might not seem like the most troubling upbringing to everybody, but every one of those little things affects a child, and all of it clearly affected John. But just to be clear, it's not because his parents were pieces of shit. Now I want to tell you about Robert Thompson, who had the exact opposite kind of situation of John. He had not so great parents. Ann Thompson came from a home of abuse from her father, and she married Robert Sr. when they were both 18. I'm just going to refer to him as Robert's dad so that there's no confusion with the name. Robert was born in 1982 and was the fifth of 7 kids, and they were all boys. Can you imagine?
Absolutely not. Boys, I'm sorry, boys are wild. Y'all are rough. Y'all are rough. I have my dainty little baby girl, and I don't know if a boy will tear this whole place up, but seven kids is already a lot within itself.
Yes.
And I'd like 7 girls would be a lot. Definitely. All the emotions, all the, yes, no, I cannot. I don't see how people had so many kids back in the day. My grandma had 11 kids on my dad's side, and my grandma on my mom's side had 9, if I'm not mistaken.
That's a lot. I can't even imagine. Fucking
kids.
So yeah, they had 7. And the 7th child actually was from a different father. So his mother, Anne, had a drinking problem, and his dad was abusive. Not only did he physically beat Anne in front of the children, he was also physically and sexually abusing all of the kids. Robert's dad accused him of stealing something once around Christmas time. So when he asked Robert where it was, Robert was like, I didn't take it. I don't know what you're talking about. So his dad made him strip naked and held his genitals and threatened to cut them off if Robert didn't tell him where it was. When Robert was 5, his dad left the home. Him leaving did not stop the neglect and the violence, though. The brothers had all learned to be violent, and they picked on each other. Additionally, Anne's drinking problem worsened. The kids were all severely neglected, and at one point in time, Anne attempted suicide, and so did one of Robert's siblings. Though Robert and John had incredibly different childhoods, they did have something very major in common, which is that they were both held back a year in school. Because of this, they both felt like outcasts, and they hated school, which attributed to their skipping habit. They became friends in September of 1992, and that's when John began skipping with Robert. Because before that, only Robert was skipping school. Just to bring you back to the day, we are talking about February 12th, 1993. On this particular day, the boys headed to the New Strand Shopping Center in Bootle, Merseyside, which is in England. And it's sometimes just referred to as the Strand. They went to the mall to steal stuff. And they stole whatever they could when store workers were occupied. And this day they got batteries, blue paint, pens and pencils, a troll doll, makeup, candy, a wind-up toy soldier, and other miscellaneous trinkets. They tossed the soldier down an escalator, and they actually didn't keep most of what they stole. They just got a thrill from stealing it. People were asking them why they weren't in school, because they were walking around the mall, and they were also in uniforms. And they were like, oh, it's a holiday. Inside of a department store, John and Robert were attracting the attention of 2 little kids, a 3-year-old girl and a 2-year-old boy. They were siblings. And the mother saw John and Robert opening and closing purse clamps from the rack, keeping the attention of her kids. She was kind of put off by it, so she called the kids to come back to her side. But just a few minutes later, when she was paying for her items, The kids strayed near the older boys again. When she finished checking out, the mother saw her little girl alone. She asked where her brother was, to which the little girl said, "Gone outside with the boys." I can only imagine the panic that shot through her body as she ran outside, and she yelled her son's name. And she was watching John and Robert, motioning for her 2-year-old son to follow and come with them. But with the mom spotting them, John told the kid to go back to his mother.
I don't know what their plan was. I don't want to know right this second, but I know you're going to tell me.
I'm about to tell you.
I would have shit 10,000 bricks had one of my children went missing. Once again, this is why we have babies with backpack leashes.
I used to think those were so silly, but now I think it's a great idea. I know. So John and Robert went back inside of the shopping center to a stand that was by the butcher shop so that they could get some candy. And it was there that they spotted 2-year-old James Bulger. James Patrick Bulger was born on March 16th, 1990 in Liverpool, England, to Denise and Ralph Bulger. Denise was the 12th of 13 children, and at age 16, she left school to begin working. Her biggest goal was to be a mother. The couple lost their first child by stillbirth, and at this time, James was their only child. Denise was 25 years old at the time. Denise had gone with her brother's girlfriend, Nicola, to the shopping center at 2:30 p.m., Nicola was exchanging merchandise in a store while Denise stayed outside and watched James. He was fussy and he didn't want to be in his stroller. She gave him a snack, hoping to make him calm down, because food makes everybody calm down. And while inside of a kid's clothing shop, James was tossing things around, full of energy, and Denise was getting ready to go. She just wanted to stop at the butcher and leave. So the butcher mixed up the orders, and it took a little bit longer than Denise was anticipating. She was holding James, who was being fussy, so she decided to let him down since there wasn't hardly anybody in the shop. And that's where John and Robert spotted James, standing in the doorway of the butcher shop, eating Smarties. It was 3:40 p.m. John said to James, "Come on, baby," and took his hand. Robert led the way. To passerbys, it merely looked like two brothers leading their baby brother through the shopping center. When she went to leave a moment later, Denise realized that James wasn't there, and she panicked, running back into the shop. Denise was sent to security, where she gave a description of James. Now, security wasn't worried. They had even that day already had to call out for a missing kid in the mall. So they called over the intercom James's name, and they waited for him to wander back into the office. And Denise and Nicola searched some shops while security looked and waited for James. But he didn't come back.
How old was James again?
2. He was just short of 3 years old.
So he was 2 and they called his name and expected him to come back.
I think, well, they also put his, like, description on there. So I think they were also saying, oh, you know, if somebody sees him, to bring him to the office.
Okay. Because I was going to say, like, Ollie's 3. And if Ollie heard her name, like, on an intercom, she wouldn't, I'm almost positive she wouldn't know, like, she wouldn't have paid attention to it.
Or know where to go. You know, the hope was that an adult would see James and be able to lead him to the security office. At 4:15 p.m., they called the police to report him missing. As John and Robert left the shop with James, he cried and began being fussy. They had to actually carry him. They eventually sat him down and asked him if he was all right, to which he cried for his mom. The boys attempted to hold James's hand as he walked, but he frequently ran ahead a few steps or fell behind a few steps. But nevertheless, he followed the boys, unsure of what else to do. The boys led James under a bridge to a canal, completely out of sight in an isolated area. The boys joked about pushing James into the water, but what they were actually gonna end up doing is much worse. One of the boys, and they blamed each other, so it's not clear which one, picked up James and dropped him down on his head, giving him an instant bruise and a cut on his forehead. He sat next to the canal crying, and it startled John and Robert a little bit, and they walked a little ways away, leaving him alone for a few minutes. But they went back to him, and once again said to him, "Come on, baby." James, not knowing what else to do, followed the boys. They pulled his hood over his head to disguise his new injury. Taking his hand, they led James back on the road they had previously been on him and crossed the busy road. People saw them, saw James with the cut on his head, but nobody said anything. Because why would they? Why would they know that anything is abnormal? He's just walking along the street with two other boys, presumably his older siblings. John and Robert weren't sure what to do with James, so they led him through the streets, pulling him along by the hand. Several witnesses saw them. One witness saw the boys trying to pull James by the hand, and he was resisting. And they saw Robert give James a, quote, persuading kick in the ribs. They walked over a mile down the busy road. Several witnesses described seeing James crying and not wanting to go with them, and recall wondering where the parents were. James, at one point, ran and tried to run into the street, into oncoming traffic, and the boys pulled him back. And witnesses recall thinking maybe the little boy was upset because he wasn't allowed to run into the street. Robert and John carried James to a grassy area by a reservoir where they all sat, James between them. A witness saw James laughing with them, and another witness in their home saw one of them grab and punch James before shaking him violently. This person closed their curtains and minded their own business. I understand why people who were on the street when they were just walking didn't know to say anything. I get that. But this person who saw them shaking and punching James, that breaks my heart that they didn't call police.
I've said before how, like, I would buy my business when it comes to certain situations. But, like, if I'm seeing some kids beat up a little baby, like, he's a baby. He's a toddler.
He's a, like, baby, yeah.
He's a baby. Like, if I seen anybody beating up a fucking baby, best believe I'm gonna go over there and I'm gonna punch them in the face. I don't care if you're 10. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
So you either mind your own business or you get too involved. We need to find you a happy medium.
there's no happy medium with me. It's either you getting your ass beat if you're however old beating up a baby, or I'm gonna just leave you alone if you're an adult.
Well, a little while later, an elderly woman was passing the boys when she saw James, who was clearly injured, with the two boys, and James was crying. And finally, somebody asked them what's going on. John and Robert said, "Oh, we just found him at the bottom of the hill." And the woman was like, "Okay, well, go to the police station." It was really close by, and she told him how to get there. And so they got up and began walking in the opposite direction. She called out to them, but they ignored her. So the woman who, in that same area earlier, had seen James laughing, was passing by, and she told the elderly woman that she had seen them earlier laughing. And so the two of them justified it, saying that the boys were probably just inexperienced in watching their younger brother. Even though they just told the elderly lady that they just found him.
Right, like, and then now you're chalking it up to his older brothers? The fuck?
Also, I just want to say, and it's not this elderly woman's fault. I want to make that very clear. But if it were to happen that two 10-year-olds tell you that they just found a child at the bottom of the hill, don't just tell the children to take the small child to the police.
No, you fucking get that kid and you take him to the police.
But again, it's really easy to justify stuff when you're in the situation.
You are correct.
So that night on TV, the elderly woman saw that the toddler, the same one that she saw earlier, was a missing person. So she called police and told them what had happened. Now the boys continued to walk, gathering the attention of several more people. Another person inquired what was going on. This would be the second of two people who would ask them what was going on. And the boys told them all the same thing. They found the lost boy and they were taking him to the police station. Except now, they were nowhere near the police station. But John interjected when they were asked about it, and he said that the station was on their way home. Robert was getting nervous, so he let go of James's hand. But John demanded that he take it back, as he fed the stranger's lies. One woman asked James if he was all right, but he didn't answer. The woman had her own small child with her, and though she wasn't comfortable with the situation and wanted to escort them to the police station, she had a child of her own who was tired and was fussy, and she had to leave. So she didn't have any choice but to let the boys go. They wandered in and out of shops and down more busy roads. They even got kicked out of a pet store. In addition to several adults seeing them, two older boy acquaintances spotted John and Robert. They had planned to use a pair of fake handcuffs on them, but they were surprised by the toddler being with them. So the boy said it was John's brother. And one of the boys claimed to have said to them, quote, "If you don't take him home, I'll batter you." By 5:30 p.m., it was getting dark. Robert, John, and James approached the entrance of the railway. The police station was really close by, and it was also really close to Robert's house. Now, they had a lot of options of where to go. But with all of James's apparent injuries that they had already caused, they chose the railroad tracks. John ripped the hood off of James's jacket, since his face no longer needed to be concealed. They had walked over 2.5 miles. The attack began sometime after 5:45 p.m., but before 6:30 p.m. And this is when I want to give you that trigger warning. If you don't want to hear about the attack, go ahead and just fast forward about one full minute. One of the boys threw the blue paint at James's face, getting it into his left eye. They threw stones at him, beat him with bricks, and kicked him. They removed his shoes and pants, and it is unclear whether or not they sexually assaulted him, but his foreskin was forcibly pulled back. His underwear were soaked in blood and found near his head. They hit him with a rusty railway fish plate, which is an iron bar that's used to connect the end of two rails. The iron bar weighed 22 pounds, which is 10 kilograms, and they hit James with it over the head, causing 10 skull fractures. They placed batteries in James's mouth and also possibly in his rectum. They covered him partially in bricks and debris, and they laid James's body on the railroad track. He suffered a total of 42 injuries, 22 of which were to his head and face. The boys left James when he was still alive, and he would die before a train split his body into two. The autopsy could not identify the specific blow that killed James. He had excessive brain damage and a giant hemorrhage in the center of his head. When John and Robert left the railroad tracks, they headed to a friend's house. The friend wasn't home, so they walked a little further to a video store. And that's when John's mom, Susan, found them. She yelled at the boys because she had been looking for them for hours. Allegedly, Susan beat on the boys. Robert ran home, and Susan led John to the police station for a lecture because she had just reported him missing. The officer on duty at 7:15 p.m. gave him a lecture, and Susan told John about how a boy had gone missing that day and that John could have been kidnapped also. When Robert got home, he told his mom that Susan was beating them, and Anne reported it to the police, and at the police station, an officer saw a scratch under Robert's eye that they presumed was caused by Susan. When James was on the news, tips came flooding into police. Keep in mind, the boys had walked through several public areas, including in and out of stores and along busy roadways. Shortly after midnight, police were finally able to watch the CCTV footage from the mall. And they had received some tips about an older guy at the mall with a ponytail who was seen talking to some children. So they were kind of expecting to see this guy near the area. But when they finally spotted James at 3:42 p.m., they saw him hand in hand with a small child and another child in front of him who led them to the exit. But the video footage was just blurry enough that neither of them could be identified. James is identified by the location in his clothing. But other than a sort of description of the clothing that the other boys were wearing, police had no idea who was leading him away from his mother. Now, this picture is probably something that people have seen if they are familiar with this case.
Picture with him holding the other kid's hand.
Yes. Have you seen this picture before?
I've never seen this picture before. And this is eerie as fuck. And I hate you for making me look this up right now.
It's super eerie.
That little baby.
Yes. And so from this image, the police figured that the boys were teenagers, maybe like 13 or 14. Or from the video, I should say, because they had an actual video of it. We're just looking at a still of it.
Yeah, they look pretty big compared to him.
Yes. So police also had received tips about seeing James near the canal. So they sent an underwater team to the canal and had land searches the next day. Blurry images of the boys who led James out of the mall were released to the public. But again, they were so blurry that they were impossible to identify. Robert's mom actually asked him straight up if he was one of them. She was considering that it might be. Police decided that checking what kids were absent from school on Friday, February 12th, would maybe start to lead them in the right direction, because all kids who were in school at the time obviously had an alibi. On Sunday, February 14th, a train engineer noticed something on the tracks. Though he was used to people putting stuff on the tracks, his mind wandered to the missing signs for James, so he called police to report it that evening. But by then, he had already been discovered. Four boys were walking along the railroad tracks when they stumbled upon what they first thought was either a cat or a doll. But to their horror, it was James's body. Detective Albert Kirby would arrive at the scene to conceal it. John and Robert may have thought that it would look like a tragic accident when the train hit James, but instead, quote, James's body had been severed with some distance in between. It was as if there were two crime scenes, two bodies to examine. The upper part of his body, at first, appeared to be nothing more than a bundle of clothing. His lower half, however, was starkly naked. Police determined that James had been laid by the waist onto the rail, with his upper body on the inside of the tracks. It looked as if his head had been covered with bricks, but the force of the train disturbed the arrangement. The lower half of his body had been carried further down the track. They knew immediately that it was homicide. Bloody bricks, the iron bar, and a tin of blue paint were also found in close proximity to his body. Once the news of James being found was public, Robert brought a rose to the crime scene to pay his respects with other mourners. A 12-year-old boy got arrested and questioned about James's murder, and the town was so riled up about it that they actually went to his home and broke windows and were destroying some of the property. He obviously hadn't been charged yet, and he never would be because he wasn't involved. But that's how outraged people in the community were. When Susan told John about James's body being found, he said, quote, his poor mom. But that didn't satisfy his dad, Neil. He noticed that there was blue paint on John's coat sleeve, and he had heard on the news about the blue paint at the scene and on James's body. John shrugged it off, saying that Robert threw it at him. And even though they know that John skipped school that day, the Venables did not suspect John of being capable of something like that.
I mean, of course not. It's your child. You never would suspect your child of committing something so fucking heinous ever in your life. No matter how fucked up you think your kid is, or no matter what type of kid they are, you would never think, oh, my child is going to be this kid that does this bullshit here.
Especially something so cruel.
Exactly. Like, it's just, what do you say? Like, it's just not fathomable to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's why police from the get-go were so surprised that it was two little boys bringing the other little boy out of the mall. Because you don't suspect somebody so young to be so evil. But someone else also noticed this paint on John's jacket, and they anonymously called in a tip to the police. The person incriminated John and his friend Robert, who both missed school on Friday. Police thought that the boys were too young to be their suspects, but they followed up on the lead. So they went to their houses in unmarked cars and picked up the boys for questioning at 7:30 a.m. on Thursday, February 18th. They had a search warrant for the house, and when they showed up to the Thompson's house, Robert began to cry. The police collected some of his clothes, including a pair of shoes, which had blood on them. At the Venables home, Susan was less than surprised to see the police. She told John that he shouldn't be skipping school, and based on her reactions after that, I kind of think that she thought he was just being brought in for being like a truant, not because he was a suspect in the murder. But I don't know that. That's just a speculation. So police collected his jacket with the paint on it, which also had a small handprint on it. James sobbed and said, quote, "I don't want to go to prison, Mom. I didn't kill the baby. It's that Robert Thompson. He always gets me in trouble." The police put John into their car, and on the way to the station, he asked about Robert. He wanted to talk to him, and he wanted to know if they had already arrested him. Once at the station, police collected blood, hair, fingernails, and fingerprints from both John and Robert, but they were separate. John, when being fingerprinted, asked 1,000 questions, which included, quote, "Do you leave these on whatever you touch? If you touch someone's skin, does it leave a fingerprint? If you drag someone really hard, do you leave your nails in his skin?" Really incriminating questions, honestly, but right, just circumstantial. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the interrogations. I'm going to start with Robert. Robert was questioned with his mother, Anne, and a lawyer. He maintained his composure through most of the interrogation. He was pretty used to being in trouble, and with his childhood, he was used to putting on a cool and collected face. Robert told them that yes, him and John had skipped school that day. They went to the Strand and they walked around. And while on the escalators, he saw James and his mother. Now, police perked up when he said that, because why on earth would Robert notice this particular child and his mother? The mall was super crowded that Friday, so it seemed like a really odd detail to investigators. Robert said that after the mall, they went to the library before heading home. Police told Robert that John said that they didn't go to the Strand, and they asked him why John would lie about that. Robert decided to take this opportunity to say, maybe it's because John did something wrong. He said maybe John got the baby to follow him and then lost him, but he wasn't sure because he didn't look over his shoulder. The police show Robert that the jacket he was wearing matched the jacket of the boy in the CCTV footage with James. Robert just shrugged it off and he's like, yeah, lots of people have jackets like that. They pointed out John's more distinctive jacket, and Robert essentially told them that if John was with the boy, he didn't know it. This kid's 10 years old.
Right.
10. Can you imagine being like that in an interrogation?
Absolutely not.
At one point, Robert began to cry. And between his tears, he told police, quote, "I never touched him." He finally admitted that it was John who had James. At first, he told police that they let him go by the church. But he later said that he left James and John at the railroad tracks after John threw the blue paint, and he didn't know what happened after that. After hours of questioning, Anne pleaded with Robert to just tell the truth. So Robert agreed, and he says that John went into a out-of-control killing frenzy and threw a brick at James's face. He tells them that John threw more bricks, hit him with the iron bar, and threw the batteries at James while he stood there begging John to stop. He said of it, quote, "I tried to get him off. He just kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him, and I couldn't do nothing about it." Police tell Robert that they think that he also hit James, to which Robert said, quote, "Well, that's what you think." Robert goes on to tell police that he tried to move James off of the tracks, and that's why there is blood on his shoes. He stopped when he realized how much James was bleeding because he didn't want to get in trouble for ruining his clothes. He said that he left a rose at the site because, quote, "Because then baby James knows I tried to help him up there and I'm thinking of him now." When police asked Robert about the possible sexual assault and about potentially sticking batteries up his rectum, Robert got mad. He was super upset, saying that he wasn't a pervert. He stopped cooperating and answering questions after that. Throughout the interrogation, Robert kept saying that he knew he was going to get in trouble and that John, who was the actual troublemaker here, was going to get off fine. So now let me tell you about John's interrogation. Again, these boys are incredibly different, and this is just another example of that. Unlike Robert, John was not cool and collected. He was hysterical from the very first moment. He had his mom, Susan, there, and Neil was also there, though he wasn't physically in the interview room while it was happening. He had a really hard time talking at all with Susan there, so police actually had to have Susan and Neil tell John that they will love him no matter what and to please just tell the truth. John told investigators first about his relationship with Robert. He talked about how Robert was a bad kid, unlike all of his good friends. He said Robert was always getting them into trouble and liked to skip school and steal things, and John would never do this on his own. John's version of events was also a total lie, but completely different than Robert's. He said that the two of them skipped school, went to the park, the cemetery, and the railway. He said he even stopped Robert from stealing flowers. He denied going to the Strand until he was confronted by police with their knowledge from Robert's interview. Eventually, John admitted going to the Strand, but denied kidnapping a child. Investigators continued to tell John different pieces of Robert's story, and John backed himself into a corner by telling contradicting lies. Confronted with his lies, John admitted to leaving James at the canal after James was walking around on his own at the Strand. With more hysterics and pleading from the Venables, John finally admitted it. He said, quote, "I did kill him." He asked Susan to tell James's mom that he was sorry. John went on to tell police that Robert did the majority of the beatings and that he only threw two small stones at James and they were not at his head. He said, quote, "No, I didn't really want to hurt him. I didn't want to hurt him or nothing because I didn't want to hurt him with strong things, only like light things. I deliberately missed."
The fact that you wanted to hurt him at all is the problem here, little boy. Like, the fuck do you mean? He's only 2 years old. And you wanted to inflict pain on him. No matter how big or how small, you still wanted to hurt him. It's bullshit.
It's really disturbing. According to John, Robert was the one who removed James's clothes, and Robert was shouting at James, and after hitting him with the iron bar, James fell onto the tracks and the boys ran off. He also became hysterical when the batteries were brought up, and he said he didn't know what Robert did with them. At 6:15 on Saturday, both boys were charged with the kidnapping and murder of James Bulger. They were also charged with attempted kidnapping of the other child at the mall. Before I go into the trial, I think it's a little bit important to tell you about how children are convicted of crimes in the UK. So in England and Wales, the age of criminal responsibility is 10. So that essentially means that if you're under the age of 10, you're considered too young to be held responsible for a criminal act. Some people think that this age should actually be higher, and this is based on a concept called doli incapax, in which you have to decide if a person can distinguish right from wrong and understand the consequences of their actions. John and Robert definitely understood, and psychiatrists and former teachers both took the stand to testify to this point. Additionally, police played pieces of the interrogation in which both boys clearly understood the nature of the crime. It was the first time either of them had heard part of the other person's interrogation, so they got to actually listen to what the other boy said about them. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So in the eyes of the court, Robert said that John's idea was, quote, "Let's get a kid. I haven't hit one for ages." But according to John, Robert said, quote, "Let's get this kid lost. Let's get him lost outside so when he goes into the road, he'll get knocked over." Now, based solely on their appearances and attitudes, Robert was considered to be the leader. He was shorter and pudgier, and he had a troubled past. And as you recall, he was calm and collected through most of the interrogation. John was slim and tall, and a lot of people considered him to be naive, and he was hysterical through the interrogation, so they kind of thought that he was probably the follower. By the time of the trial, the boys were 11 years old, and their identities were hidden. So they were called Child A, which was Robert, and Child B, which was John. The court built a raised platform that the boys sat on during the trial so that they could see, but they were shielded from the public eye. John's family came to court every day to support him, but Robert's mom was not there. James's family also went every day, except for Denise Bulger, his mom, who at this time was 7 months pregnant. Doctors warned her that the stress could cause a miscarriage, so she only came for the judgment. Robert and John were accompanied by social workers, and they were not required to participate in the trial. They did not take the stand, and they were rarely addressed. But they were tried together. 38 witnesses took the stand and testified about seeing the boys with James. There was an overwhelming amount of evidence beyond the witness testimonies. The blood and the paint on the boys' clothing were also matches with James's body and the crime scene. On November 24th, 1993, taking just 6 hours, the jury found both Robert and John guilty. Denise came to court that day, and John sobbed, and Robert was still and collected because he said he knew they were going to be guilty. They were the youngest convicted murderers in Britain at that time. They were sentenced to a minimum of 8 years, but the Lord Chief Justice recommended that they serve the maximum time, which is 10 years. The intention was that they would be in separate secure units until age 18, in which they would each be transferred to an adult prison. People were pissed, because that is not very long, and Denise fought, and there was a petition that over 280,000 people signed to have the term increased, and it was given to the Home Secretary. It included thousands of letters of support for a sentence of at least 25 years. In 1994, he announced that the boys would serve 15 years, which is still way too short, but a lot better than a minimum of 8. In 1997, the House of Lords decided that it was unlawful for the Home Secretary to do that, and they overturned this decision. Then in 1999, the European Court of Human Rights decided that there had been a violation of Article 6, which stated that the boys had an unfair trial because it was held in an adult court where they could not fully understand the intimidating proceedings. Following this, the Lord Chief Justice decided that the boys would serve the initial 8-year sentence. So in June of 2001, the parole board decided that they were not a threat to society, and the boys were released. They were given new identities and were in a sort of witness protection program, but for criminals, criminal protection program. That way, their lives wouldn't be at risk for what they had done. They were prohibited from visiting Merseyside, Liverpool, which is where it took place and where James's parents lived. And they were not allowed to contact the Bulgars or each other. They were in secure units, which is basically a juvenile detention center, and they were put into separate ones. Their parents were allowed to visit them as frequently as they wanted. Robert had nightmares and what people have called PTSD-like symptoms. He was harassed by fellow inmates and was afraid to leave his cell. In 1995, Robert slowly began to talk about what happened and would later admit that he was a participant. John had terrible nightmares about James and fantasized about saving him. Both of them passed their A-levels, which is part of a general education certificate. John allegedly had sex with a female member of staff from Red Bank, which is the juvenile detention center that he was in, when he was 17, shortly before his release. She was supposed to be escorting him during exercise through the grounds, and they ended up having sex in an empty staff residence. She was accused of sexual misconduct and fired. Now, Red Bank at the time was threatened to close because of social services inspections, so the incident was pretty much covered up to prevent closure.
Of course it was. Isn't that like statutory rape?
Not in England. You have to be 16.
Ah, okay.
So, I read a couple conflicting things about the conditions of the juvenile detention centers, but from what I read overall, it seemed like it was not a bad place to be. I don't want to say too much about it just because I can't verify that much information, but some people have said that, some resources said that they're like, they had access to PlayStations and things like that. So not really sure how much of a detention center that was.
Right.
Now, in case anyone forgot that people are assholes, there are so many people who did terrible cyberbullying type shit during this time. Someone stalked Denise. Another person sent her Twitter messages, pretending to be one of the murderers, which they actually served 2.5 years in jail for that. And someone even made a Facebook group called "What Happened to James Bulger Was Fucking Hilarious."
The fuck?
Additionally, people posted pictures of other people claiming that they were John or Robert, telling them to share it so that everyone knew what they looked like. Some people also posted their supposed new identities. In 2008, it was discovered that John had been to Livermore many times, even though he was technically banned from going there, and he was going clubbing and snorting cocaine there. He had a series of younger girlfriends. In 2010, at age 27, John was found with child pornography on his computer and ended up in jail for 2 years. He also had been catfishing people and was playing a 35-year-old married woman who told people about abusing his made-up 8-year-old daughter in hopes of getting more child porn. After his release, John was given another new identity so that once again he could escape from from his past, is kind of what it feels like, honestly. In 2017, John was arrested again for child pornography and for owning a sort of pedophile manual with advice on how to molest and groom children. He was sentenced to 3 years and 4 months in 2018, and in September of 2020, he was denied parole. So as far as I can find, he is still currently in jail. Robert has been completely out of the spotlight and out of trouble since being released from jail. In 2006, he came out as openly gay and in a same-sex relationship, and that's the only information I can find about him since the murder. After James's death, Denise couldn't bear to stay in their home and see all of James's toys and clothes, so she moved in with her mom. Her and Ralph began growing apart, both dealing with grief in a different way. Denise bottled everything up and blamed herself and Ralph turned to alcohol. Ralph at first also blamed Denise. When Denise gave birth to Michael 2 months after the trial, it did not bring the couple back together. Ralph left the home and they divorced in 1995. Denise wrote a book entitled I Let Him Go, and she goes through the stages of blaming herself instead of it, quote, "When you've lost a child, you go through stages. You blame yourself, you blame others. But at the end of it, there are only two people to blame in this, and that's the two who took him. But it did take me a long time to realize that and get my head around it. It wasn't me that killed James." In 1996, Denise met Stuart Fergus, and the two later married. They went on to have two more sons, Tom and Leon. Denise now runs the James Bulger Memorial Trust at forjames.org, in which they give free holidays to victims of crimes and to disadvantaged families. Ralph also ended up remarrying and having three daughters. So that is the tragic story of James Bulger.
Wow, that was brutal. And the fact that they only got 8 years.
That is such a short amount of time. 8 years. 8 years.
For murdering and torturing a baby.
What's crazy too is if, because they were like 10 and a half at the time, if they had been like 6 months younger, they would have got off scot-free.
That is wild.
I just can't, I mean, I understand that there has to be a point where you have to determine somehow whether somebody understands consequences and right from wrong. But, I mean, just the whole thing with a maximum sentence of 10 years and they only serve 8. I can't wrap my head around it. What a fucking insult to James.
It is. And I'm sorry, like, I would want everybody to see who the fuck murdered my child. I stand by that. I want everybody to see. I want everybody to look at their ugly little faces and see the monsters that murdered my child. I don't care. I don't care how old they are. It's ridiculous. Like, the fact that I think it was John that was saying that he was the one that was saying he wanted to cause some harm to him. Not a lot. That clearly shows you he knew that I was wrong and he was purposely inflicting harm on a little baby.
A baby.
A baby. The fucking 48 months. That's essentially what. Wait, no, I lied.
No, he was almost 3. He was a month short of being 3.
Yeah, almost 48 months. Just think about that.
Where are you getting 48 months from?
I don't fucking know. It's 36, right?
It was 35 months 36. old. 36. This is why people shouldn't tell you their kids' age in months. Because nobody knows what they're saying.
I'm like, bruh, she's 2. She's about to be 3. Or she's 3. She's about to be 4. Like, this is it. After she turned 1, it was, all right, she's 1. 1.5.
You were like the only person who does that. And I appreciate that. Because obviously math is difficult.
It is, and I'm no mathematician, but anyways.
He was just short of 3 years old, which is just unbelievable. And, I mean, it's crazy because it's not anybody's fault but the two boys that decided to take him and take his life.
Absolutely.
But how crazy that something like that can happen in broad daylight in a public, busy place.
That's scary.
It is. And that image is haunting. So if anybody knows what it is, or if you looked it up, it's not creepy in the same way that some of the other videos and images that we've talked about are, but it's very eerie because that's the last moment that we see them really captured on surveillance.
It's what looks to be like a teenager walking with a little baby or a little boy, and they're holding hands. So you assume that it's a older brother and a smaller brother or just a family member, whatever. But then you realize what actually happened to him, and they're walking him to his death.
Yes. And you can see too that there's people all around them.
Surrounding them. It's a heavily populated area.
if I were to look at this image in any other circumstance, I would 100% just think that was somebody walking with their little brother.
Right.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. But, you know, it's just another good thing that they had this footage. I mean, they had a lot of other overwhelming evidence, but that just, you know, that photo being out there is just another reason that somebody knew to call in that tip, because they're like, wait a minute. Exactly. That's totally them. You know what I mean? And so it's good that we have cameras everywhere and that the world is watching. It's a good
definitely. Thing. Definitely. Definitely.
Killers can get caught on tape. And that's why we're doing this season.
Yes.
To show you that tape is good and it's okay that our phones are watching us and stuff like that.
Sometimes.
Thank you guys for continuing to listen. We appreciate all of your support. You can connect to all of our social media, send us an email, send us a request, a listener story. You can subscribe to our newsletter. All of that is available on our website at
craftsdraftsandcrime.com.
Thank you for listening. Until next time. Bye.